And we're back, and we have got, thanks to a bunch of talented people, we've got our guest, I believe, Des Dalton, Republican Sinn Féin. Are you there, Des?
I am indeed, Phil.
Hey, my apologies, Des. And also, my condolences. We had the privilege of meeting Roy O'Brady, and anybody who ever met Roy O'Brady knew he was a genuine, sincere, intelligent, outstanding spokesman for a cause, and he was a man of great principle. And so you have our condolences, and we want to, and I know that you spoke at the funeral, and I believe he died on, was it June 5th or 6th?
June 5th, yeah, that's
June 5th.
Right.
And let's go to this matter of the who Rory O'Brady was. He's just, everyone just says he was a traditional, central figure in the, from dating all the way, his ideas and principles dating to Wolfe Tone. In what way is he that continuation of the struggle for One Ireland?
Yeah, well, I suppose in many respects he epitomized it and came to represent it. Now, Rory would have been the first to say, you know, it's not about the personality, it's about the principle and it's about the cause and the ideology. But I suppose I should say, Phil, even in terms of how he represented it and how he articulated it, what he articulated was exactly that, an essential Irish republicanism, drawing very much from that rich tradition of, you know, stretching right back to Tone. You know, Rory, actually with his son, Conor Croher, said it, you know, speaking during the funeral mass, where he said that his father didn't have a sectarian bone in his body, and it was really true. I mean, one of the things that was an essential to Rory was the whole idea of uniting the people of Ireland, Catholic, Protestant, at the centre, and, you know, I suppose one of his lasting political achievements was the formulation of the Éire Nua political programme for a federal Ireland, and that was very much based on that premise of bringing people together, of creating a political space within which all the people of Ireland could create a new Ireland. So that was very much the core of what Rory O'Brady was about. And, you know, in the days after his death, you know, there was descriptions of him as, you know, the hardliner and so on. And what Rory was somebody who very clearly saw what the core issues were and, you know, what the cause of conflict in Ireland was. And he identified it, as indeed did many other Republicans before and since, that, you know, British rule and British occupation and the partition of Ireland were a root cause, and they needed to be dealt with. And then after that, it was a matter then of creating that space within which all of the people of Ireland then could build a new Ireland. But that's what motivated Rory O'Brady. As he would always say himself, I mean, it was the idea of wanting a peaceful Ireland was, you know, to the core of what any, you know, human being would want to see, but it was how that was brought about, and, you know, creating the conditions in which that could be brought about was, you know, the motivation of Rory O'Brady throughout his life.
Yeah. Could we ask you kind of an outline of his life a bit, his life story? His father was involved in the struggles in the 30s and such. If you could tell us how his career roughly.
Yeah, very briefly, yeah. His father, Matt Brady, and indeed his mother, May Caffrey, were both active members of the Republican movement. His mother had been in Cumannamon while a student in UCD, had fought. Both of them took part in the War of Independence. His father was, in fact, very badly wounded during that. So he was an independent Republican county councillor then in Longford in the 1930s. So he very much grew up in a home in which republicanism and independent thought was very much there. So yeah, I mean, and then himself, obviously, as a student in UCD, I think in 1950, he joined the Republican movement. He joined Sinn Féin, and very quickly then graduated onto the IRA from there. And you know, in reflecting on his life in the days and the weeks after his death, and one of the things that struck so many people was that the level of involvement of him is almost unique. In fact, I would say it's unique in modern republicanism. I mean, he's a man who held three positions. He was a TD. He was elected as a TD in 1957. He was chief of staff of the IRA, and he was president of Sinn Féin. I don't think anybody else has ever held those three positions. And from 1956 when he became a member of the Army Council of the IRA, almost with very small breaks in between, he almost continuously, right up to his death, was involved at a national leadership level in the Republican movement. You know, like he died a member of the Ar Cordia of Republican Sinn Féin as well as being patron. So, I mean, the level of this man's involvement and commitment is unique probably in Republicanism. You know, we describe him as a towering figure of Irish Republicanism, and he was that for, you know, the latter half of the 20th century. He himself and people like Donoghue O'Connell really were the outstanding figures there.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was always so impressed, and am, by the way, I'm sure you are, with this biography done by Robert W. White, The Life and Politics of an Irish Revolutionary.
Yes, I was about to mention it, actually, indeed.
And you know, what was striking, or is striking, about his life, Rory, all the time he was out dealing with his fellow Republicans, he himself had done everything. He'd been on a hunger strike. He escaped from the British, and his brother also was involved in a hunger strike, right?
That's right. His brother Sean was director of publicity for Sinn Féin. That's right, indeed. And in I think it was 1972. Both of them were actually in hunger strike. Exactly, Phil. I mean, you know, you take the CV of this man as a Republican, and there's nothing that he didn't do. Indeed, the famous escape from the Corran internment camp with Donoghue O'Connell in 1958. Mm-hmm. You know, as I say, chief of staff, president of Sinn Féin. You know, he was a man who represented republicanism on an international world stage as well. Indeed, throughout the 1970s and the 80s in particular, where he travelled, you know, throughout Europe and indeed into North Africa. I think famously, from a Canadian perspective, I think it was 1997, he was actually refused entry to Canada, where he was going to attend the ceremony at Gross Hill, where the famine memorial is there. Mm-hmm. So he was, you know, he was a man who visited Capitol Hill in Washington in 1973, met with the then Speaker of the House of Representatives, Tip O'Neill, and so on. And, mm-hmm. you know, I suppose really, yes, he was that towering figure. And, you know, I'm not sure if you're aware or not, but the scenes at his funeral, where the police of the southern state, the 26 county state, you know, came in riot gear, and there was an open carrying of weapons and so on. And in many ways, it was an inverse tribute by the 26 county state to a man who'd been an implacable enemy of neocolonialism and of imperialism throughout his life, that even in death, it was as if they still feared him. And, you know, there was some disgraceful scenes actually in the cemetery where there was an attempt made to ring the graveside by uniformed and plainclothes Gardaí. Right. And
they do fear Wolf Tone, don't they? They do fear
absolutely.
They do fear Patrick Pearse, because these are powerful ghosts, and their words are honorable and clear, and each can cite the other. Rory's words and Rory's analysis has been very growing more persuasive over the years.
Absolutely, Phil. You know, to read back, and as I say, in the days after he died, leafing through Bob White's book, Professor White's book, you know, Rory Lebrady, I think as events have unfolded over the last number of years, the depth of his analysis and the intellectual rigor that he brought to that analysis has been shown to have been very, very accurate. You know, a lot of what he spelled out, you know, would transpire. It did, and actually, just on a lighter note, he told a story himself of a journalist who came to him at some point in 4 or 5 years ago, and said to him, "You know, I've come to talk to you because you seem to be able to forecast all of these various crises as they occur within the so-called peace process." And Rory laughed and he said, "Well, look, I'm not an oracle. I don't have any second sight or anything." But he said, and he pointed to his bookshelves and he said, "It's there." He said, "For anybody who wants to see it, it's there in the pages of history." He said, "Study your history." He said, "The same tendencies, forces, and trends are there and will play out, you know, and will continue to play out." And exactly, mm-hmm. Phil, I mean, that's it. I mean, what he spoke was the truth. He didn't try to please anybody. He spoke what he believed to be right. And I think history will be very kind to him, exactly. And I think the ideas that he espoused, that sense of idealism, is something which does hit I think the nobler instincts of people, and I think that's something that official Ireland fears, and I think not just in Ireland, I think we see it internationally, where you know, that sense of idealism and so on that inspires people, you know, the powerful fear that, you know, because it does inspire people, and it does make people to look up beyond the mundane and the everyday, and it makes them inspire something better.
It's always a lesson, isn't it? I mean, when people say, no, these are my principles, you could take them or leave them, but they're principles. That's where people really must rally, because those who say, well, those were my principles yesterday, but today I put an asterisk and I've changed it to something. Obviously, people cannot rally to that for fear of being humiliated. To someone who's going to change their position. On this matter, I think it's so important. I was, and I don't know if you accept the analogy, but I was reading the president of Syria, President Assad, and he said, people who try to bring sectarianism into our one country of Syria are the our enemies, and they're working for the colonialists. And, boy, that rang a bell for me when I was thinking of your arguments, Rory's fight around the so-called Stormont Agreement, and it's, you pointed out in your speech at his funeral that he had said this is going to this agreement will feed sectarianism, and it will also increase British, I think the word is copper attach or something.
Copper fasten, that's right. Copper fasten. Copper fasten, British rule, and so
British
on.
Rule.
Yeah.
Those are the two points. Now, could you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. I actually wasn't aware of that. It's quite an interesting statement. I must look that up myself. Yes, and indeed, another man who is very much in the news at the moment, Nelson Mandela. Some, you know, when they were negotiating the end of the apartheid state, one of the solutions being mooted at the time was a partitioning of South Africa to create some kind of a white, you know, quote unquote, a white homeland state. Mm-hmm. And Mandela said, you know, we're not going to have a South African Ulster. There's not going to be a partition of our country and so on. And absolutely, you know, and used exactly those words to describe it. Exactly, you know, that idea of introducing, and it's supposed to, as old as colonialism itself, this idea of dividing people along either religious or ethnic or tribal lines, creating artificial minorities and using them to police the colonial rule and so on. And you know, we've seen it in our country. I mean, the proclamation of 1916 talks about, you know, artificial divisions carefully fostered by an alien government. And, you know, Tone identified it, you know, in his day in the 1790s and so on. So exactly, I mean, it goes to the root of what republicanism is about.
By the way,
what we see in Ireland today is an increase in sectarianism, particularly in the six counties. We see increases in the peace walls and, you know, deeper divisions amongst people. And all of this comes about as a result of a bedding down, if you like, that copper fastening that we were talking about there, of what is essentially an undemocratic and artificial state. Mm-hmm.
And it should be, as you outlined, it should be appreciated that he and others, like Sean McBride and others in 1974, and at other moments in modern history, he was present when this issue was on the table. It's not as though there is an attempt to marginalize and suggest he's the marginal one. But in fact, what Rory was putting forward was there to be accomplished, and he had interlocutors who were actually considering it. It was other elements who sabotaged.
Oh, yes, indeed. You know, the fecal talks in 1974, where, you know, Rory, among other Republican leaders, met with representatives of the Church of Ireland and of Protestant stroke Unionist opinion, and particularly, as you say, Sean McBride and the McBride Bowl talks. I mean, one of the things was said about Rory O'Brady was that there was all kinds of calumnies kind of laid at his door after his death that, you know, he was responsible, he was a hardliner and a militarist. In fact, as you quite rightly point out there, Phil, the McBride Bowl talks actually held out a great opportunity to forestall that kind of conflict, particularly coming from the Lila side. And there was great possibilities that could have come from that. And they were actually scuppered by a Dublin government minister, the late Conor Cruise O'Brien, who actually went on RT Radio, Irish National Radio, and exposed the fact that those talks were going on. And one of the things that was essential to those talks was the fact that there were being, they were confidential and they were secret. And once they'd been exposed, then obviously it undermined confidence, particularly of the Lila side, to continue with the process.
A bunch of people thought they were going to lose
that, you know, particularly in the 1980s and so on, you know.
It strikes me that that point you're making about Conor Cruz O'Brien and others, that a lot of people saw their careers going up in smoke.
Absolutely.
One last point I want to make sure we underline too, because I read a very marvelous essay by Rory, and it, it can be found on the net, where his argument for socialism, and people don't, not enough people, I believe, understand it. Roy Obradi was a socialist. Could you talk about that?
Yes, indeed, and you know, he didn't make any secret of the fact. You know, even in the 1960s, he made it clear at the time. I think the phrase he used at the time was that windows needed to be opened on the Republican movement, and you know, a lot of new, fresh thinking was required in social economic terms. Absolutely, Rory Obradi would be the first to say that. You know, a bit like Condi, it wasn't just about Ireland, but it was also about her people, and you know, it was about creating a kind of Ireland which was worthy of all of those ideals, an Ireland that. Not only had political democracy, but also social economic democracy, and that was very much to the core and to the heart of Rory Obradi. I one of the phrases he would always use was, you know, our cause is the cause of humanity, and he saw the Irish struggle not just about the liberation of the Irish people, but he saw it in an international context as well. I think basically, you know, whatever people's class or whatever people's creed or religion would be, he always took his fight. And took a stand with the oppressed in whatever colour, creed or nationality they might be the Irish or be the Breton or be the Algerian or whatever, Palestinian or whatever they would be. I think Rory Obradi stood on the side of the oppressed, and I think that, that will be his legacy and that will be his testament. And just one final point that I'd like to make, Phil, in the foreword, the introduction to his biography, Ed Maloney, a very fine journalist and somebody I have the utmost respect for, I think in a very well-intentioned way, said that described Rory Obradi as the last or one of the last of the Irish Republicans. I actually would disagree with Ed on that. What I would say is that far from being one of the last of the Irish Republicans, I think it's because of the work and the dedication and the commitment of someone like Rory Obradi that far from being the last, I think he's ensured that Irish Republicanism lives on and indeed has been passed on to another generation.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. If the journalist could look down the road, he'll find Rory way up ahead of him.
Absolutely.
And Des, it's been great talking to you. RSF.ie. People can find the Republican Sinn Féin statements and, of course, memories of Rory. And Des, I congratulate you. I know you're a great leader of the party now, and I hope we can talk to you again in the future.
A pleasure, Phil, as always. Yeah. And again, thanks very much for your kind words there at the beginning in terms of condolences and so on. And certainly we look forward to talking to you again.
Okay. We look forward to it. Thank you. Bye-bye. That's Des Dalton. And again, the site, go to rsf.ie. And I got a quote here that apparently that Rory used to like to tell people. And of all people, he's quoting somebody, a rather great American writer named Louisa May Alcott, famous for her part of participation in the struggle for many great causes, particularly cause of women, but she was also an abolitionist. And she wrote, "I slept and dreamed that life was beauty. I woke and found that life was duty." And that was something that Rory liked to cite to people. And boy, he lived like it was duty. He was a pleasure to talk to and to know. And of course, it was a pleasure talking to Des Dalton to remember him. There's really no disputing that Roy Obradi was a man of fine character. And by the way, he was a school teacher. And I didn't get to his commitment to Gaelic. He always wanted to make that effort.